Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
I explain what arbitration is, what mediation, but when I tell them the advantages of mediation, I'll tell them you'll have full control of the risk. No one will be deciding for you.
Although most lawyers have no problem recognizing that litigation and settlements go hand in hand, for many of us, the idea of an arbitrator acting as a mediator or vice versa is not something we would usually consider. We'll have the arbitrator do the arbitration, and if we want to mediate, then we'll get a good mediator. One good reason is the confidentiality of the mediation process. A party may be reluctant to share confidential information and settlement positions with the person who may then decide their case. In this return visit to IDN, however, Barcelona-based mediator and arbitrator Mercedes Tarazón discusses an interesting technique she uses when sitting as an arbitrator. It's a form of MedArb or ArbMed in which she encourages parties to use their abilities as commercial negotiators and her skills as a mediator to review the case together and become their own amiable compositeurs. By looking for the right moment in the arbitration, she's found that the information delivered in the course of the proceedings can be leveraged to help the parties reach satisfactory outcomes through agreement. From a recent experience, I can say this technique is one that is safe to try at home. A colleague of mine recently tried it in a German arbitration, suggesting that the three arbitrators try to mediate a settlement in the course of an evidentiary hearing. It worked, and a settlement was reached. As Mercedes points out, this innovative technique actually has its roots in the historical arbitration practices of many countries.
There's a long tradition of the exequo et bono arbitration, el amigable componedor, the arbitrator sitting as exequo et bono, rendering the word exequo et bono, was the preference for many years. Look at the Spanish Arbitration Acts. In 1953, there was no possibility of institutional arbitration, so there was no real, not many cases going on. 1988, excellent arbitration act, and said, if the parties don't say anything, the arbitration will be exequo et bono. If they want it to be according to law, then they have to expressly say so.
Really?
Yeah. 2003, they changed it.
They flipped it.
Now, they flipped it, and that was the other way around. So, I mean, if parties want it to be exequo et bono, they have to expressly say so, which is the international practice by now.
Right.
But in 1988, which is already a very late date in order to make such a choice, the Spanish ruler went for the exequo et bono as preference. And this is because in the philosophy, in the way of doing arbitration or understanding, because maybe there weren't that many cases, but the way of understanding the role of the arbitrator, it was someone who would render the word exequo et bono. We are doing, when I'm explaining that to the parties, I go a step forward and I'll tell them, look, that wouldn't be the best. Because if I render an award according to law, then your lawyers can really calculate which will be my decision according to their strength. But if I were to do it exequo et bono, instead of me doing my best to try to think what is fair, why don't you do it? The ones that know the business, why don't you do that effort?
But you don't advise them to have you decide to issue an award.
No.
I want to do it on law. You advise against that as to the arbitration.
Exactly.
Award.
If I sit as an arbitrator, I'll sit as an arbitrator and I'll render an award according to law, the applicable law in the case. Okay. But I make them see the differences between one thing and the other and the advantages. Having a third person that doesn't know the business, rendering decisions exequo et bono, you have no control whatsoever for the risk. At least, if it's a decision rendered according to law, you can more or less make a risk assessment.
No, but what you're saying is, be your own amiable compositor.
Well, and of course they are not amiable compositor, but certainly they are doing that.
Right.
And then it's very, because it's about explaining. It's communicating and making them feel comfortable. We all enjoy being at home.
So when you do this, you do suspend the proceedings, assuming that they agree at this point.
Assuming that they agree?
That they agree that they would like to pursue this process. As a practical matter, how do you proceed? You see, you get the parties together, you sit them down and you say, let's try mediation. And both sides say, yeah, well, why not? Let's try it. Do you do it right there, or are you? You set up a date?
I've never started. When I've been appointed as an arbitrator, I start as an arbitrator, and I have parties presenting their claims as an arbitration because it helps them. It helps them to realize the strengths and weaknesses of their cases. Sometimes, I won't say always, but sometimes mediation fail because they are premature, because parties still haven't worked their best alternative to a negotiated agreement, and they still believe they are very strong and everybody's going the arbitrator or the judge is going to give them everything they're asking for. If parties were sophisticated enough, they would have done all that job in advance. They would have maybe we could enter mediation right from the beginning. I've only entered mediation right from the beginning when I've been appointed as a mediator. But I think there's a huge room for opening the door to mediation in procedures that are either court proceedings or arbitration proceedings that are taking place. But who's the one that's going to do that? In the court, it will be the judge. But in arbitration, it is either the institution, which I think it should be one of the roles of the institutions. But there's a lot of things. Well, there's some trying to do it, but
No. But they're different philosophies. In fact, in an earlier podcast, we actually had Mark Capel from the ICDR and Melanie Milhack of the ICC, and they have different philosophies. The ICDR's approach is they sell solutions. In other words, they're indifferent as to whether or not the parties wind up with an arbitration award or a settlement agreement. In fact, I think Mark said they prefer the parties to wind up with the settlement agreement because that would make them more inclined to return to the ICDR next time. Melanie takes a different position, and actually Jason Fries, the Secretary General of the ICC, has explained it also in a podcast that he had with us, and that is that because mediation is just not well known in many parts of the world, the ICC is reluctant, given its presence in 100 different countries. They think that for them to push mediation on the parties may I think, undermine their perceptions, party perceptions of neutrality they may have. So you've got really, diametrically opposed approaches between these two institutions. One that says we're going to try and sell you on mediation, and I've had that happen to me in ICDR arbitrations where you get the letter from the case manager saying try our mediation services, and the ICC, which has a very capable mediation staff, but if you're in arbitration, you never hear anything about mediation from their case managers.
Well, but institutions could do it.
So
the ICDR does it.
So
if it's ad hoc, who's going to do that? It's the arbitrator.
Unless the parties do it.
Of course, if the parties are always free to do that. Yeah. But in the court will be the judge proposing that. In the arbitration ad hoc, it will be the arbitrator, the arbitral tribunal. In my case, I've always seated as a sole arbitrator. Right. For the moment. So what do I do? I make it clear right from the beginning which are the possibilities, and I get the consent of the... For the moment, they've always given that to me, but if they would say, no, we only want you to sit as an arbitrator, fair enough. I love sitting as an arbitrator also. So if they accept, once I've explained everything, then we enter the arbitration. Each claimant produces, then the defendant, then they propose the evidence, whatever the evidence proposed and accepted, then we have the hearings of the witnesses, all the rest of the documents are produced, we go through that. Once we've seen that, if I see that there is room for more, that there is a zone where people can reach an agreement, because sometimes it's simply someone that has unduly terminated the contract or refuses to pay. And there maybe you can try to, maybe there is room for negotiation, but perhaps once the award has been rendered and then the party who needs to pay, maybe you can find a suitable way for that party to pay if the party can't afford to do it right. But sometimes, there is no zone for an agreement, for a negotiated agreement. But often there is in commercial cases. Often there is. So once you as an arbitrator, besides during the evidence period, you can ask as other things you think that are needed. That's one of the power that you have as an arbitrator, and it's very useful because it helps to put all things that are needed on the table. And once you have all these things on the table, and you've heard the witnesses, and you've heard the parties' submissions, and each one has heard the other one's evidence, then if I see there is room for a mediation, then I put it in written to the parties, and I tell them, according to what we saw in the first hearing and you agree to that possibility, I think that now would be a right moment for you to try mediation.
So you actually...
And then I propose a calendar.
Mercedes, you prepare this from day one in the arbitration.
Exactly.
Very interesting. So you put it into the first meeting. You say there may come a point in this arbitration where it would make sense for us to sit down and try to mediate. And you wait for that moment. And if that moment comes, then you say, this is the moment that we agreed to.
Everything has been explained. I have got their consent to change hats. So later on, the award will not be challenged because of that. I have got their consent to... Because there is the issue of neutrality.
How many of these... What's the percentage settlement rate when you do this?
For the moment, 100%.
100%.
Because...
Will you disclose the numbers? How many arbitrations is that?
That means 12 arbitrations.
12 arbitrations, and all at that point went to
settlement. I must say one thing. In Bolivia, 8 of these cases are Bolivian ones.
Yeah.
Okay. In Bolivia last September 2007, there was a bill produced in order to derogate, to cancel the Arbitration and Conciliation Act. And there was, you know that Bolivia is going through a very difficult political period, and there was huge concern. Many cases started. Well, many. I was appointed in two.
People were worried that their arbitration clauses would be held to be not valid.
Exactly. The Arbitration Act would have been derogated, there was no room for that arbitration.
Because arbitration in Bolivia wasn't valid.
Exactly. It wasn't valid any longer. So you had either go to court or...
Maybe talk about the place of arbitration being very important.
Venues in arbitration being a thing.
The A thing that you want to consider before you sign a contract. Where are the arbitrations?
But these were domestic cases, so it was clearly Bolivian Arbitration Act. So I was appointed in two. If I rendered an award and later on the arbitration was derogated... If the party that was to pay did not want to, the party who had won the arbitration would be unable to go to the court and try to have the award enforced. So there was a huge need to try to have things settled in a way that would be respected, and there was respected by everyone. That would be fulfilled by everyone. And besides, there was a huge need to do things in a quick way. To have parties.
How many of these have led to, you think, repeat appointments? I mean, the fact that the parties settled. Obviously, if they settled...
In the Bolivia cases, it was like that.
One after the other.
It was like that.
Word got out that you were doing this.
I was blocked there for 3 months. And believe me, communications were not that easy. So it came to a moment that the rest of the world were asking, where is Mercedes? And I was down there. But it was... very enriching because every case is different. You learn a lot and you develop and you know, it's like sharpening the technique every time you propose that to parties. And actually, this very first hearing where I explain things, I do it as if I were a teacher. Not as a teacher, but, you know, I draw things, I draw the icebergs, I explain, I put examples. As if I were in a conference.
But I come from GE, a company that believes strongly in mediation, but that's really a culture, for the most part, of lawyers. I mean, I too have to explain what mediation is to business people in different countries. Many countries where, as you know, people are not familiar with the practice, and I do some of the same things that you do. In fact, what I do is I try to take the formality out of it and simply say, it's just another form of negotiation, right? There's going to be somebody else there who will facilitate the negotiations, and maybe sometime where we're going to be sitting in a room by ourselves, but But it's what you do. It's what you do naturally. You negotiate. And then when you put it in those terms, people, it clicks, you know, and then they're not afraid, and they like the process.
You need to make feel parties comfortable. We all like to feel at home. And we all feel scared when we don't have the feeling of more or less controlling the situation. It is true that often lawyers are an obstacle for the development of mediation. The moment you make feel parties comfortable, you make them feel at home, then things can be done in a smoother way.
When we were speaking before we started recording, you mentioned, we started listing the countries where you've conducted mediation, you've acted as a mediator: Spain, obviously, Switzerland, Peru, Italy, Bolivia, Morocco, Mexico, Ecuador, Chile. And then I think we stopped counting. But does anything change with the venue, in your view, and how the mediation actually gets done, how it's conducted?
For the moment, not.
And that's something that's amazing.
For the moment, not.
It's a completely universal. This is facilitated mediation.
It's the one I use. Yeah. I mean, I know that in other countries.
Which is the plenary session following by caucusing.
No, the plenary session or the joint session. I do keep the parties together as much as they can, okay, because in the jurisdictions where I sit, confidentiality is not ruled. It is not only the way it is perceived, is that the protection of confidentiality is not as huge as it is in the US or in England and Wales.
Yeah, that's right. That's many places, right? Many places don't have any laws which protect, also preserve,
exactly,
the confidentiality of the settlement process or the mediation process.
In the jurisdictions where there is more risk for the confidentiality issue, I do split more in caucuses, because, I mean, at least the information they share, it will not later on be used by the other party against.
Because
you know what I mean?
You keep it secret to you.
I keep it secret to me, okay? Right. But if not, I try to have as many joint sessions as possible.
But why more joint sessions rather than more caucusing?
Well, it is not that I have.
Well, because if you do this in the middle of an arbitration, they've already seen their positions, they've seen the evidence, and maybe what you're doing is a vetting of what they've already heard and helping them face into it.
No, but, I mean, once you get the people, the business people there, and of course, lawyers have a role, and also in arbitration, and in mediation, sorry. So there is an opening statement, limited in time, for the lawyers to expose in front of their clients the strength and weaknesses of the case. And they are already in the evidence period, so they've seen everything. And then I ask the parties whether we can focus on business. And because I've had the opportunity as an arbitrator to have them declare, I know whether they have assets here, whether they're considering selling also more strawberries and berries. I mean, Bolivia, Cochabamba produces lots of berries for Brazil. Oh, by the way, I've also had Brazilian parties for Brazil, and they sell a lot. So whether they've considered selling more or producing more berries, because Brazil market eats a lot of those. So you know a little bit about the business, because you've made them talk about that while they were declaring in the arbitration. So then you ask them about that and more about that, and you have information. And then from there, things go on. If I see the need to have a private session, a caucus, I have it. I would say that saving face is a universal value, not only in China or Latin America, but it's certainly something that is
nobody
important.
Let's put it this way. Nobody likes to look stupid.
Exactly. Nobody likes it. So, I mean, if I see that parties will feel more comfortable telling me whether their last proposal alone and in private session and then join. I mean, you see that because, I mean, one thing that's very important is to build the relationship with the parties and with the lawyers so people feel comfortable, you know. You see their need and the way they ask, or whether we are having a coffee break, and then say, but previously you said there was that possibility of having a small talk with you alone. They're asking for a private session. I mean, you don't need to make it very complicated. So then you go back to the joint session and you say, well, maybe it would be the right moment for us. And, I mean, it goes. It's trying to make it smoothly. And you were asking me about how do I do it. Okay, I send this. Right. I send a letter and proposing already a timetable. for the moment, they've always accepted, and we've followed that. And when we've reached the agreement, because always there's been a settlement agreement, a full settlement agreement, then in the cases where I've been sitting as an arbitrator and appointed as an arbitrator, I render an award by consent.
Oh.
There wouldn't be the need.
No, they get the arbitration award. It's
exactly.
There
wouldn't be the need because it's a settlement agreement, and all the settlements agreements I've seen, at least
so
the ones.
So get a settlement and an arbitration award together.
Yes, just okay.
Normally your letter, when you say that now is, I think, a good time for the mediation, do you leave it to the parties to schedule it, or do you propose a certain
No,
time
I
period?
Propose it because in advance, I need to control my schedule and my agenda. I need to know where I can be and where I cannot be.
I suggest
blah, 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 of course.
Yeah.
Because if not, then, I mean, when often we say that the arbitration takes longer than it should, it is true that some arbitrators
because
have...
people like you have busy schedules, that's why.
Exactly. No, but if you organize yourself and you say, okay, if I have the hearing here, maybe there I'll see, so I keep that week free for that, so that I can be there an extra week or an extra 5 days. And then because everything is so ripe, it goes very quickly. It goes very quickly.
Great. Well, listen, thank you very much. We'll have to have another discussion in the future about given your experiences in so many different countries and also the lack often of knowledge and awareness of mediation, we need to have a discussion with you about standards and certification so that mediators around the world, and because it's an audio podcast, you know, nobody can see Mercedes shaking her head at me. But we got to have a talk about why standards might help someone like develop more the awareness about mediation in those countries. But that, again, different podcast.
Different flag.
Thanks.
Thank
for
you.
All right.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.